And now,
the definition.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Vi Merides, and this is quite unusual. Usually I do not do this for a new episode, but I'm going to start off with a very brief comment about this episode. I have thought about doing this episode for a while, probably about 6 or 7 months. However, it wasn't going to include John Edwards. It was just going to be on Elliot Spitzer, which I always thought to be a political hit. Well, in actually doing this episode, or in preparation of doing this episode, you know, kind of sitting down and thinking about what I really wanted to talk about, it came to me that Edwards should be included because, well, you'll see as you listen to it. Now, as always, and I guess to my detriment, I don't talk very much about, you know, facts and, you know, it's basically hearsay, I guess. And it's just my personal observations of what happened. I don't, you know, list sources, but, you know, it's general knowledge that I talk about, and then I just take that general knowledge and I extend it. There is going to come a time, I think, in the future when I'll produce a couple of addendums where I will present, you know, some audio clips and, you know, maybe post some YouTube things that you should look at and check out. But for right now, all I have is this. And I didn't really give a reason as to why I produced this episode, particularly since I placed it as the last part in an election series portion. It's pretty obvious that, you know, I wanted to connect the whole idea of Edwards and Spitzer being presidential to the current presidential elections. But moreover, I wanted to connect their expulsion with an expulsion that I'm seeing happening all across the Democratic landscape. The expulsion of true progressives who can actually enact true systematic change. You know, as much as I like Dennis Kucinich wasn't going to enact systematic change. He just didn't have the big personality and the wherewithal to do it. You know, Russ Feingold, I think of as the same way. He just didn't have the grit to do it. As lawyers, I think Spitzer and Edwards did have the grit to do it. They were used to looking at individuals who obviously didn't like them and looking at them smiling and saying, oh, you think you don't like me now? Wait till you see what I'm about to do to you in the next 2 minutes. You're really not going to like me. And then followed through on that promise and forced that person to do something that they had absolutely no desire to do. That kind of power, when allowed to run free in a legislature or a legislating chamber, could be dangerous, especially if Spitzer started racking up wins. You know, if he got the New York legislature to go along with some of his plans, or change the legislature, which is very well dominated by the Republicans. Even today, I know it's supposed to be 50-50 or close thereof. You know, even the Democrats are mostly conservative. But these individuals posed a real threat to the rise of the DLC, Democratic Leadership Council, and the true rise of the moneyed interests within the Democratic Party. So they had to get rid of them. If this was Rome, they would have been stabbed and murdered. They would have been, you know, choked to death. This isn't Rome. And you just can't go around killing people anymore. Doesn't look good. What would people say if Elliot Spitzer was murdered? Or if John Edwards was murdered? Wouldn't look good. So, you murder them another way. Public opinion. And public opinion is deadly. Can be deadly. You don't believe it? Ask Tiger Woods. Ask O.J. Simpson. All you have to do is get the right media stations to say the right things about a person, and their image is shot. There's nothing they can do about it. And when the media branded both of these individuals as untrustworthy because they cheated on their wives, nobody blinked an eye. Nobody. Well, some people did, but very few people did. I suppose hindsight is always 20/20. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this extraordinarily long podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, or if you know of any audio clips, video clips even, that have to do with this, please send them to me, classwarbattlefieldpodcast@live.com. Before I even get into that that audio, I'm actually going to start off with a Greg Palast piece on Elliot Spitzer's whole thing. So enjoy that and enjoy the rest of the show.
This is Greg Palast reporting for Air America Radio's Clout. And this is Elliot's Mess. The $200 billion bailout for predatory banks and the charges against Governor Elliot Spitzer are linked intimately. While New York Governor Spitzer was paying an escort $4,300 in a hotel room in Washington, just down the road, George Bush's new Federal Reserve Board chairman, Ben Bernanke, was secretly handing over $200 billion in a tryst with mortgage bank industry speculators. Both acts were wanton, wicked, and lewd. But there's a big difference. The governor was using his own checkbook. Bush's man, Bernanke, was using ours. Last week, Bernanke's Federal Reserve, for the first time in its history, loaned a selected coterie of banks one-fifth of $1 trillion to guarantee those banks' mortgage-backed junk bonds. The deluge of public loot was an eye-popping windfall to the very banking predators who have brought 2 million families to the brink of foreclosure. Up until last Wednesday, there was one single, lonely politician who stood in the way of this creepy little assignation at the banker's bordello. Elliot Spitzer. Who are they kidding? Spitzer's lynching and the banker's enriching are intimately tied. How? Follow the money. The press has swallowed Wall Street's line that millions of U.S. families are about to lose their homes because they bought houses they couldn't afford or took loans too big for their wallets. Baloney. That's blaming the victim. Here's what happened. Since the Bush regime came to power, a new species of loan became the norm, the so-called subprime mortgage and its variants, including loans with teeny teaser interest rates. From out of nowhere, a company called Countrywide became America's top mortgage lender, accounting for 1 in 5 home loans, a large chunk of these subprime. And here's how it worked. Let's take the Grinning family with U.S. average household income. They get a $200,000 mortgage at 4% for 2 years. Their $955 monthly payment is 1/4 of their income. No problem. Their banker promises them a new mortgage, again at the cheap rate, in 2 years. But in 2 years, The banker's promise ain't worth a can of Spam. And the Grinnings are told to scram because their house is now worth less than the mortgage. Now, the mortgage hits 9%, or $1,609 plus fees to recover the so-called discount they had for 2 years. Suddenly, payments equal 42% to 50% of pre-tax income. The Grinnings move into their Toyota. Now, what kind of American is subprime? Guess, no peeking. Here's a hint. 73% of high-income Black and Hispanic borrowers were given subprime loans versus only 17% of similar-income whites. Dark-skinned borrowers aren't stupid. They had no choice. They were steered, as it's called in the mortgage sharking business. Steering subprime loans with usurious kickers, fake inducements to overborrow, called fraudulent conveyance or predatory lending under U.S. law, were almost completely forbidden in the olden days, that means the Clinton administration earlier, by federal regulators and state laws as nothing more than fancy loan sharking. But when the Bush regime took over, Countrywide and its banking brethren were told to party hardy. It was okay now to steer 'em, fake 'em, charge 'em, and take 'em. But there was this annoying party pooper, the Attorney General of New York, Eliot Spitzer, who sued these guys to a fare-thee-well, or tried to. Instead of regulating the banks that had run amok, Bush's regulators went on the warpath against Spitzer and states attempting to stop predatory practices, making an unprecedented use of the legal power of so-called federal preemption. Bush bots ordered the states to not enforce their consumer protection laws. Indeed, the feds actually filed a lawsuit to block Spitzer's investigation of ugly racial mortgage steering. Bush's banking buddies were especially steamed that Spitzer hammered banking practices across the nation using the state laws of New York. Spitzer not only took on Countrywide, he took on their predatory enablers in the investment banking community. Behind Countrywide was the mother shark, its funder and now owner, Bank of America. Others joined the shark fest. Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, and Citigroup's Citibank made mortgage usury their major profit centers. They did this through a bit of financial ledger domain called securitization. Securitization. What that means is that they took a bunch of junk mortgages, like the Grinnings, loans about to go down the toilet, and repackaged them into something called tranches of bonds, which were stamped AAA, top grade, by bond rating agencies. These gold-painted turds were sold as sparkling safe investments to U.S. school district pension funds and town governments in Norway. No kidding. When the housing bubble burst and the paint flaked off, investors were left with the poop and the bankers were left with bonuses. Countrywide's top man, Angelo Mozzillo, will earn a $77 million buyout bonus this year on top of the $656 million he pulled in from 1998 to 2007. That's over a $500 million for Angelo. But there were rumblings that the party would soon be over. Angry regulators, burned investors, and the weight of millions of homes about to be boarded up were causing the sharks to sink. Countrywide stock was down 50%. And Citigroup was off 38%, not pleasing to the Gulf sheikhs who now control Citi's biggest share blocks. Then, last Wednesday, the unthinkable happened. Carlyle Capital went bankrupt. Who? That's Carlyle, as in Carlyle Group. James Baker, senior counsel. Notable partners, former and past, George Bush, the Bin Laden family, and more dictators, potentates, pirates, and presidents than you can count. The Fed had to act. Bernanke opened the vault and dumped $200 billion on the poor little suffering bankers. They got the public treasure and got to keep the Grinnings house. There was no quid of a foreclosure moratorium for the pro quo of public bailout money. Not one family was saved, but not one banker was left behind. Every mortgage sharking operation shot up in value. Mozillo's countrywide stock rose 17% in one day. The Citibank shakes saw their company stock rise $10 billion in an afternoon. And the very same day the bailout was decided, what a coinkydink, the man called the Sheriff of Wall Street was cuffed. Spitzer was silenced. Do I believe the banks called the Justice Department and said, take him down today? No, that's not how the system works. But the big players knew that unless Spitzer was taken out, he would create enough ruckus to spoil the party. Headlines in the financial press. One was, Wall Street declares war on Spitzer. Made clear to Bush's enforcers at the Justice Department who their number one target should be. And it wasn't bin Laden. On the night of February 13, Spitzer made the boneheaded choice to order takeout in his Washington hotel room. That day, he had just finished signing these words for the Washington Post about predatory loans. Quote, not only did the Bush administration do nothing to protect consumers, it embarked on an aggressive and unprecedented campaign to prevent states from protecting their residents from the very problems to which the federal government was turning a blind eye. And, Spitzer wrote, right in the headline, that Bush was, quote, the predator lender's partner in crime. The president, said Spitzer, was a fugitive from justice. And Spitzer was in Washington to launch a campaign to take on the Bush regime and the biggest financial powers on the planet. Spitzer wrote, quote, when history tells the story of the subprime lending crisis and recounts its devastating effects on the lives of so many innocent homeowners, the Bush administration will not be judged favorably. But now, the administration can rest assured that this love story of Bush and his bankers will not be told by history at all, now that the Sheriff of Wall Street has fallen on his own gun. This is Greg Palast for Air America's Clout. And let me add a note on prosecutorial discretion. Back in the day, when I was an investigator of racketeers for government, the federal prosecutor I was assisting was deciding whether to launch a case based on his negotiations for airtime with 60 Minutes. I'm not allowed to tell you the prosecutor's name, but I want to mention that he was recently seen shouting, Florida is Rudy country! Florida is Rudy country! Not all crimes lead to a federal bust or even public exposure. It's up to something called prosecutorial discretion. Funny thing, this discretion. For example, Senator David Vitter, Republican of Louisiana, paid Washington, D.C. prostitutes to put him in diapers. Yet the senator was not exposed by the U.S. prosecutors busting the pimp ring that pampered him. Naming and shaming and ruining Spitzer, rarely done in these cases, was made at the discretion of Bush's Justice Department. Or maybe we should say, indiscretion. This is Greg Palast, reporting.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, class Jim, war. Show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Brian Mary Deese, and welcome to a Class War Battlefield podcast. This is the fourth part to the new format, episode number 5, which is on the election. The title of today's episode is The Assassination of President Edward and President Spitzer. I want to, of course, start off by saying to you, no, you are not in some alternative reality where there was a President Spitzer or President Edward. But I am using that terminology to kind of grab you, because this podcast is a reflection on the Democratic Party's purging of progressive and I like to say individuals who understand the system. So maybe systematic progressives from the party. And I consider Spitzer and Edward two of those people. Or Edwards, I believe it's Edwards, not Edward. Let's take a look at these two individuals before I really, I guess, get into the meat of this. But, you know, all of this is meat, may I say. But back in 2008, when Elliot Spitzer, of course, went through his debacle with the whole prostitute thing, I wrote a blog on MySpace, and I've been trying to find it recently, and I've unfortunately have not found it yet, and I'm hoping though to be able to locate it and post it. But I wrote a blog on MySpace, and I do mean MySpace, not Facebook, which said that what was happening to Elliot Spitzer was clearly a political assassination. It wasn't a physical assassination, but it was a political assassination. Back then, I was what you might call a political infant or a political juvenile, maybe even a political youth. I was in my 20s. I was in college. But I had no idea about politics. Indeed, most of what I knew about politics was emotionally related. I could kind of give some depth to my thinking, but I had not studied enough to comprehend or understand the, quote, issues of the time. And I say, quote, issues because I don't consider things necessarily issues unless they are manufactured. I consider things as problems, social ills that need to be taken care of, that need to be diagnosed and healed, need to be maybe applied some surgery to it and healed, you know? I that's what I consider. I don't consider them issues. Issues are manufactured. You know, that's why we have magazines which are issues. But I looked at Elliot Spitzer and the governor that he had been during the past 2 years, and the things that he had prescribed for the ailing New York economy. One of those such things was dividing the state up into economic zones, and then putting an economic task force in each zone to look at what each zone did well and then to develop an economic plan of development for each zone, which to me made tremendous amounts of sense, because what you might do for New York City, let's say Manhattan or even Brooklyn. Brooklyn, I believe, is where a lot of the poverty is stuck at. Maybe the Bronx even. You can't do for Rochester, Syracuse, or where I live in 315 land. It just doesn't work. There's different things that each place needs in order to be economically viable. This was a radical solution. Pataki, who had preceded Elliott Spitzer, and truthfully, if Pataki had ran against Spitzer, which I kind of wished he had, Pataki seen the writing on the wall and got out before he had to do that, but Spitzer would have cleaned his clock, which would have been disastrous for Pataki because Pataki's name is circulating as a possible GOP candidate for the presidency. His name was circulating in 2008, but he wasn't stupid enough to run then because he knew George W. Bush had basically killed the Republicans for that election. His name was circulated again for 2012, but he didn't run this time. I don't know why. Probably because he didn't believe that the Republicans could win. And now his name is again circulating for 2016. But Spitzer had some radical things that he wanted to do. And this was a threat. This was a threat to Wall Street, to New York City, and to the entrenched interests in Albany. And most of these entrenched interests are conservative. Call them Democrat, call them Republican, they are conservative. They come from areas where people identify more with conservatism. Look at an electoral map of New York State, and you see a lot of red. And then you see blue, usually around the cities. Blues around the cities. This is a conservative state with population centers of Democratic majorities. This is known. This is understood. Elliott Spitzer understood that. And he went to work still with the mandate that people gave him. One of the mandates that he had, which he talked about throughout the entire campaign in 2006, was making internet free of charge for people in New York State. Why did he want to make internet free of charge? And to bring down the cost of cable television. Why did he feel that the government in New York State could do that? Because as he put it, between the United States government, the federal government, and New York State government, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars even, had been given to the telecommunication companies to build their networks. And now that their networks were built, instead of bringing prices down like they said they were going to, they were increasing prices so they can make more money. And that was not right. I remember in 2006, he talked about the fact that in South Vietnam, in Korea, they had free internet. Why is it that the United States doesn't have free internet yet? And he talked about doing this, bringing the United States, bringing New York State particularly, into the 21st century. Elliott Spitzer was a progressive. Now, I openly admit, I do not know as much about John Edwards. I've only gotten to read a little bit of things on him, but when my mind finally did catch up to the 2004 election, which I openly admit, I was completely checked out until late in the election cycle that year. I kind of read our local newspaper before it was brought out or bought out, and that's how I kind of kept track of things, but I didn't really get involved in it. Indeed, it wasn't till Barack Obama came onto the scene and I heard that speech. A friend of mine at work said, "You got to hear this speech by this guy. It's amazing." And to me it was. Of course, now I look back and I say, God, I was such a child. He didn't say anything in that speech. He said a lot of empty platitudes, but away from that, it was then that I started getting interested, and I started listening, which I have to say, I don't know how I could let it go, how I could not be engaged in 2004 after what happened in 2000, but I wasn't. And that was when I first got my opportunity to see John Edward and to hear him speak. And I fell in love with him as a candidate. And I remember sitting and listening to him talk. And I said, why the heck is this man paired with such a bad candidate as in John Kerry? John Kerry, who could put a crowd to sleep giving an enthusiastic speech. John Edward, who was a lawyer, who made his money absolutely by going after corporations who did wrong and suing them and making them pay the people who they had wronged reparations. He was good at not playing the system, but working the system for what it's supposed to be about, which is giving the average citizen an avenue to place their grievances and to have their grievances met. He was good at that. He was very good at that. Now, for governing, I don't know. People seem to like him. I believe he was in the Senate, but people seem to like him. He was very forthright with his ideas, and he had good idealism, and he had plans for how to change America, not from the outside, but from the inside out. He saw what could be done by pulling certain levers, by exercising community rights, by exercising legal rights. And he could argue it. See, Spitzer and Edward were two different kinds of politician, but they came from the same cloth. They were both lawyers. Elliot Spitzer was the politician that stood on Main Street and said, you know something? This is wrong. I'm going to go and do something about it. John Edward, and of course Elliot Spitzer, he went to the Capitol House in order to go to the courts. John Edward did the exact opposite. He went to the community center, got together with the people, not like Barack Obama did in his early days, you know, the days when he was supposedly a community organizer. But he went to the community center and said, you know something? We know that this company did this, but instead of going to the Capitol House, I'm going to go to this building over here, and we're going to set up a law office, and then we're going to take these guys to task. And that's what he did. They were both progressives, and they were aggressive progressives. And I want to give a shout out to the Frank Factor, which is quickly becoming one of my favorite progressive podcasts. You'll definitely hear me use his clips on Class War Battlefield podcast. He's a different kind of progressive, and he used the term aggressive progressive to describe people such as himself. And that's who Spitzer and Edward were. They were aggressive progressives. It's kind of like Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is an aggressive progressive. He's progressing us towards socialism. But so both of these individuals went to the courthouses and sharpened their ability to look the demon in the eye, and the devil in the eye, and the devil and the demon. The devil is capitalism. The demon are the businessmen who run it, who run the system. And they sharpen their ability to look those individuals in the eyes and say, you know something, you shall be cast out. You will not be allowed to hurt millions of people. You will not be allowed to suck out the livelihoods of millions of people, to suck out the lives of millions of people so that you can feel empowered. You will not be allowed to do that. We will stand against you. We will fight you. Yes, we may have to do it within the context of a system that you helped to build, but we are going to hold you accountable. And that's what both of these men said. It's kind of like Elizabeth Warren right now. Elizabeth Warren is the most progressive individual in the Senate, save for Bernie Sanders. She's an aggressive progressive. God, I hope she runs for president in 2016 to give us a real choice. But anyway, so these two men, they went in and they battled those demons and they battled that devil. And instead of being knocked down time and time again, when they talked directly to the public, when they went back to the main street and they said, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. This is why I'm making the moves that I'm making. This is why I'm putting in those papers that I'm putting in. This is why I'm writing what I'm writing. When they explained it in simplistic, everyday layman terms. They didn't lie to the people. They told them the truth. When they did that, the people, instead of abandoning them, even rock-ribbed conservatives, instead of abandoning these people, getting a little excited now, they followed them. They propped them up. They made it hard for the powers that took their abilities for granted, the devils and the demons, they made it hard for those entities to fight them. Because too many people now understood what was at stake and said, we are no longer following you guys. We understand that you are the devil and you who stand beneath it and underneath it, you are the demons and we're going to fight you too. And that's what they did. And they were able to win substantial cases against Wall Street, against manufacturers, against producers, should I say, against just all kinds of companies and groups of people who thought that they were Velcro. They couldn't be touched. I think it's Velcro. Maybe I have the wrong stuff, substance. But they couldn't be touched. They were too blessed to be touched. So then, Spitzer, of course, says, well, I'm Attorney General. I've been the most famous Attorney General across the land forever. So now I'm going to run for governor. And he did. And he won. I mean, a landslide just beat the snot out of the other guy. I think it was 80-something percent to... I might be exaggerating, but I mean, he really just ran away with it. And Edward, the same thing. I mean, it wasn't as definitive as Spitzer, but the same thing. Then when Edward ran in 2004 for president, he ran not as a liberal conservative or a democratic conservative. He ran... I mean, he came from a southern state, so he had to be a little bit conservative. But for the most part, the man talked about the realities of life in the underclass. He talked about what he had been able to observe by way of his law practice. That's what he was able to do. He was able to say, you know something, I've been into these horrible places where people have no voice, corporations rule, and I've been able to beat these people back. But as Americans, you don't know about these places. You don't see them on your television. Well, let me tell you about these places. Now, you know, of course, every Democratic person who runs and every Republican person says the same thing, but the reality is, when Edwards talked about these things, he talked about them in more of a moralistic way, which most Democrats or Republicans can't do. Even Mike Huckabee can't do it. Don't do it. He may try, you know, as a preacher, but he's too beholden to the system to do it. too beholden to the system to do it. So you had these two individuals who could mold the system, who can stand tall and mobilize people. You had these two individuals who understood the plight of the poor, the ignorance of the middle class, and I don't use that term lightly, but the middle class in this country is pretty ignorant. They don't understand the sociological forces being played out on the impoverished, just like they don't understand the socioeconomic instruments being played out on the impoverished. They don't get it. But these two individuals did. They'd been there in some way or another. They've helped to reconcile some of that stuff. And now they were both in very good positions where if they had shown very well, they would have been able to run away with the popular vote. Well, it was pretty well established from everything that I'm reading, in hindsight, of course, reflectively, that they wanted, that the Democratic Party wanted John Kerry to be the nominee. But they couldn't escape the fact that so many young people had flocked to John Edwards. Without John Edwards, it wouldn't have been, Bush would have won by a landslide. Because John Kerry, sure, you know, he was considered a progressive, I suppose, when he came in the 70s. But he wasn't a progressive anymore. He didn't identify with any young people. He didn't understand young people. He didn't understand the fire and the flame that motivated young people. Young people who looked back to the 2000 election and said, we had been robbed. We voted overwhelmingly for Al Gore, and you guys gave us George Bush. Young people who were angry. Young people who were angry. And then you had another group of individuals, 18, 19 years old now, 20 years old, 21, who could vote for the first time. And they understood that they had been robbed also by being given George W. Bush. They didn't want to hear about Skull and Bones member John Kerry. They didn't give two damns about John Kerry. When you broke down the polls for who voted for John Kerry and who did not during the primaries, it was young people who voted for John Edwards and not for John Kerry. But John Kerry always seemed to come up with more votes, mainly because of older voters, which to me has always been suspect because, as I've found out over the years, in 2000, the largest generation of graduates were released into the world, even larger than the baby boomers, which makes sense because, as I've said before, the baby boomers were a really large generation. Now, if those people have babies, sooner or later, you're going to have a generation that's larger than theirs. So in 2004, overwhelmingly, the young vote goes, well, not, I don't know if it's overwhelmingly, but definitely majority of which went to General Wesley Clark and Edwards. How the heck did John Kerry win? Maybe some voting tampering going on there, maybe, by the Democratic Party? They didn't want Edwards, they didn't want Wesley. Wesley, who understood the military, but was very progressive in his solutions, not only for the military, but for the society at whole. They didn't want him because he was too progressive. Far too progressive. Who knows, but John Kerry gets it. But the Democratic Party realized they have a problem. They need somebody young to pull in the young vote because people were not happy with Kerry. So they put up Edwards. Now, Edwards did not like Kerry. Kerry did not like Edwards. This was something that was completely known, but it was understood that without Edwards, Kerry couldn't win. And of course, Kerry didn't win. However, if you look at the data that came out after the election, it looks like Kerry did indeed win, but the Republicans stole it from him. But I ain't talking about that now. I, of course, believe if Edward had been the nominee, George Bush would have been history, would have been done. I might even think if Wesley Clark was the nominee, George Bush would have been history. Anybody but Kerry. Kerry was the worst candidate that you could have put up there. He didn't motivate people. But I'm rambling on about about the problems of the 2004 election. Let me move on. So they get beat. John Edwards, I think he understood that he was robbed of this opportunity to really represent people. John Edwards was a throwback to what went on in 2000. When I say what went on, you know, that's kind of the broken black language of, you know, what happened in 2000. In 2000, 2000 was a progressive election. Conservatives did not really exist in 2000. That's why George W. Bush, it was the biggest coup to ever occur in this nation, at least in recent history. That was a progressive election. It was to the point in this nation where, you know, say what you want to about Bill Clinton, but Bill Clinton had moved the political agenda in this country to the left, even though he was a centrist. People could not run for the highest office in this land without talking progressive, without talking, in some essence, socialistic. They had to talk about redistributing wealth. They had to talk about wealth inequality. They had to talk about poverty. They had to talk about getting the debt under control by raising taxes. They had to talk about holding corporations accountable. Now, I understand that in the last 4 years of the Clinton administration, some of these things he didn't do. But you could not get elected in 2000 without talking about these things. That's why John McCain ran as a center-left Republican. He didn't run as a center-right as he tried to do in 2008. He ran as a center-left. It was understood then in 2004 that what had happened was rich people had said, nope, we don't want progression towards New Deal socialism. We don't want that. We need progression towards industrial gilded ageism. That's what we need. So we're taking this election from the youth. And people understood that in 2004. And in 2004, they said, we are not going to let you do this again. We are going to elect, whoa, wait a minute. What do you mean we have John Kerry? It was a throwback. They didn't expect the Democratic leadership to give them such a crappy candidate. Edwards was the man. He was the answer to the creeping conservatism. And because he was a lawyer and he understood the battlefield of legalities and how to fight individuals on the legal field, the Democrats and the Republicans, the corporatists as they are now, feared him. So that after they beat him, and then he started saying, okay, you know something, maybe I'll become a little bit more moderate. And he did. By 2008, he was more moderate. He let himself go into the inner sanctum of the Democratic Party to try to get polished enough, you know, to get some Middle Eastern and some international bona fides. He did this to try to make himself appear more presidential. But while he was doing that, the Democratic Party, who secretly told him, I guess, that they were going to support him, because you can't do those things without party support. You can't go overseas and talk to presidents and prime ministers and, wealthy oil financiers and what have you without party affiliation and support. So they said, we'll support you while you do that, you know, if you modernize a little bit or moderate a little bit your stances, sure, we'll get you prepared for 2008. But while they were getting him prepared for 2008, they were getting Barack Obama prepared for 2008. And they understood that out of the three individuals which people were looking for to run in 2008, there was a movement to have Barack Obama run, there was a movement to have Hillary Clinton run, and there was a movement to have John Edwards run. They understood out of the three individuals that were going to definitely be at the top, Edwards posed the most danger. He was too progressive. He was more progressive than Hillary Clinton, who tried to make herself out to be this wonderfully progressive person. But my God, the woman was a former Goldwater carrier. She was a conservative. So the Democrats, they wanted to appear just like the Republicans wanted to appear in 2012, like they were inclusive. They had these three individuals knowing darn well that they weren't going to let Edwards get close enough to the nominee to win it. Iowa also scared them because what it said was this was not going to be a contest between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama if the Democratic Party didn't step in. See, they had been working. If you remember 2007, the Democratic Party had been working through its affiliates with MSNBC, within the mainstream media, to pump up Barack Obama since 2004. They had been working tirelessly to make it out to be a contest between him and Hillary Clinton. There had been so much talk about Clinton finally running for president. And yet in Iowa, what were the results of that? Oh my, it was Obama and Edwards. And they finished above Clinton. Oh, this couldn't be, because if you had Edwards versus Obama, Obama, who claimed to be the progressive, would be outed. He would not be seen as a progressive because he is not a progressive. He is a corporatist. He is a conservative. And the mainstream, or not the mainstream, but the Democratic Party knew this. So they started throwing their money behind who else but Hillary Clinton. And the media, instead of talking about Edward, they started talking about Hillary Clinton as if right after Iowa, it was a contest between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Should Hillary get out the race because she finished third? Is Hillary's career over? Oh my God. Nobody wanted to talk about John Edwards' showing. Everybody wanted to pass up his showing because they feared what it would show. They feared what it would do. It would knock Barack Obama out of the race. You put Edwards versus Obama in a state like Ohio, Edwards versus Obama in a state like Michigan, in a state like Pennsylvania, Obama doesn't win. Obama didn't win versus Hillary Clinton, but he wouldn't have won against John Edwards, who had the bona fides of unionization behind him. He could talk about working with unions, about helping unions beat back corporate America. Obama couldn't. His story was too paper thin. So now, after the media decides that they want Clinton instead of Edwards, they start pushing him out. They start pushing them out. And they win because they begin to, of course, talk about if Clinton should drop out, you know, what does it mean for Clinton if she doesn't drop out, blase, blase. And then, of course, God, I want to say Massachusetts was after that, but I'm not sure. But I know Clinton won after that. And then it was, then the talk shifted. The talk shifted. I mean, pardon me, but I don't remember if Clinton won one, the second one, or if she finished second, but the talk shifted about now it wasn't a race between Edwards and Obama as it should have been. It was now a race between Clinton and Obama, and that was the new narrative. That was the new narrative. Well, Edwards couldn't and did not get on the mainstream media, but Clinton did. even after Iowa. How is that so? Oh, well, she's the former, or she's the wife of former President Bill Clinton. Who cares? Who cares? She ran number three in Iowa. How many people have ever ran number three in Iowa and had that much media, mainstream media coverage? Even NPR didn't really go with Edward. So then, of course, after Edwards is finally forced out, and then the media wants to talk about, okay, well, you know, who is he going to endorse, blase, blase, and I think he ended up endorsing Obama. Actually, I'm not even sure. Did Edward ever actually endorse anybody? Because I think if he did, I don't believe it was made a major deal. I don't believe it was made a major deal by him. Like, maybe I'm wrong for this, but I don't remember Edward ever coming out and saying, oh my God, you know, I'm endorsing this person, and everybody who votes me, actually, I believe he did. I believe he did for Obama. I believe he did finally for Obama. And I believe that, though, was under immense pressure, that the Democratic Party, they were pressuring him to get out. Because they wanted it versus Obama and Clinton, two corporateers. Two corporateers. So then, of course, Obama gets elected. And then what does the media do? A few months later, it's time to go to work on Edward. It's time to discredit him. It's time to make it so that Edward, who could have garnered conservative votes because of his work with unions, it's time to make it so that he looks morally dispossessed. That he looks like he is not a good candidate anymore. And so now it's all of this, now, you know, in 2008, 2009, 2010, the narrative for Edwards becomes he's untrustworthy because he cheated. Ironic, isn't it? They killed, through the tabloids, through the media, two aggressive progressives by calling them morally insignificant because they cheated on their wives. How many conservatives have been charged with cheating on their wives in the public eye? Not many, huh? That's kind of funny. How many Republicans does it come out that they've been cheating on their wives? Not many, right? But these two individuals, aggressive progressives, individuals that could have garnered significant conservative votes in this nation, who might have even led an electoral revolution if they were both, if one or both were elected to the presidency, were, through the media, assassinated. They were assassinated. And the Democratic Party stood by and did nothing. So both of these individuals now assassinated, off to the side, one of which, you know, kind of steps back and, you know, dissolves from the public's eye. That's John Edward. The other one becomes kind of a personality talking on TV about the problems of the society. That's Elliot Spitzer. What does it say about our country? What does it say about our country in the future when these two individuals, the only two real aggressive progressives that had the opportunity for the election and their presidency, who could actually put together the coalition to win, when they are assassinated and the public goes along with it? Now, I'll tell you, when the entire Elliot Spitzer thing went down, I was in college, I made a mention of that, and in preparation for writing the MySpace blog that I wrote, I went through probably a few dozen news sites, just reading on stuff about the whole Elliot Spitzer thing. And it was on some, It was some English website, news site actually, England, meaning British, that I was reading through what they were saying about the whole Elliot Spitzer thing, which, you know, may I just say, they were laughing at us. The Europeans were laughing at us, but I suppose I'll get into that in a moment. And I decided to scroll down and to read the comments that people were leaving. And it was sad to me because the people in Europe were saying, give him to us. We'll take Elliot Spitzer. We'll make him prime minister. Forget about being a, you know, magistrate or whatever it is that they call their governors over there. But they were saying, give him to us. We'll take him. One man in particular was absolutely just lambasting the American public for being idiots, for being so misled, for believing that for some odd reason, if a man cheats on his wife, it has something to do with him performing his job well. Possibly. I mean, my God, if a man goes to a prostitute and, you know, he's cheating on his wife that way, well, maybe he's less stressed and he can do a better job. And he can do a better job, but I don't know. I'm not for a man cheating on his wife no more than I'm for a woman or a wife cheating on her husband. But as they said, this is a personal matter. As it was said on that news site, this is a personal matter. This has nothing to do with him performing his duties, unless he's less stressed. And it was pointed out on this website, give them a time, you know, they wanted Americans to give them a time when some person in power wasn't going to see a prostitute. Indeed, as I've come to see in recent months, as I've been reading more and more, it used to actually be pretty much well known that people in power went to see prostitutes. Heck, it in Greece, it was so well known that individuals who were in power would tell their slaves to tell their wives that they were going to see a specific call girl or prostitute. And it was well known. Now, we live in different times. I get that. I understand that. But these people didn't care about that. They said, look at the job that he's doing for you guys. How are you not standing up for him? How are you not telling these people to give you your governor back? And they couldn't believe it. They could not believe it. At the same time, of course, well, it wasn't at the same time, but some months later, when Barack Obama was running, of course, for president, he was the undisputed runner. I read some of the same sites, and, you know, of course, people were like, we want Barack Obama. And some of the other individuals who probably would have been the ones saying that, you know, Elliot Spitzer was given a raw deal, were telling people not to fall for him. And I necessarily didn't agree with them, but now I do. Anyway, what they said was correct. We should have been angry. We should have been on the streets telling them, no, you give us our governor back. We don't want this guy from New York City, David Patterson. It's a joke. It's a joke. We don't want him. Indeed, when they replaced David Patterson, who'd they replace him with? They replaced him with a corporatist. Cuomo, the son of Cuomo, of course, who is way more conservative than his father was. You know, Mario Cuomo was a rising star of the Democratic Party before suddenly being disappeared from the public stage, which I've often had questions about. A rising star in the Democratic Party, a progressive, no less. And suddenly he's just gone. But away from that, look at the timing of these things. So you have Elliot Spitzer getting knocked off, getting pushed away in 2008, right in the middle of the Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton charade. It was at least symbolic. There was at least a symbol to it, I suppose, right? The Democratic Party in 2008 and in 2009 absolutely unleashed itself, or should I say unveiled itself, as the puppet master theater that it is now. It basically let us know that its elections were no longer by popular will. It was by corporate will. Thus, John Edwards couldn't win. And his winning in Iowa had to be diminished, had to be torn down. And then after that was done, and after the election was won by Barack Obama, the man who they wanted to win, then he had to be torn down and ushered away. But as they were unveiled, they also had to get out of office the one person who could have taken the whole corporate structure of the Democratic Party down. The one person who was not part of the Democratic Leadership Council, who in 2012 or 2016 could have mounted a very good challenge to any establishment candidate that was put up. Could have done that. And they had to get rid of him, and they had to get rid of him then. In the heat of what was going to be playing out or on the national stage as an intense competition between two factions within the Democratic Party, the blacks and the women. Or the blacks and the whites, or the blacks, the Hispanics, and the whites. So then they get rid of Spitzer, knowing that people are going to be too focused on the national campaign to do anything about it. And that's exactly what happened. Now, of course, if you see Client 9, Rise and Fall of Elliot Spitzer, which is a good documentary, may I say, you're not going to see this on there. Absolutely not, because this is what you call background story. This is what you call happening behind the shadows. This is a fire causing those shadows dancing on the wall in Plato's cave. I love that. I love that analogy. But they had to get rid of him, and they did. And then they went on to play the charade. And then they had to get rid of John Edward afterward, because John Edward might have wanted revenge in 2012. And he might have come for Barack Obama. You know, I remember in 2011, people on the left middle class, talking about how there was not any viable alternative to Barack Obama. There wasn't anybody strong enough to challenge Barack Obama and to take the presidency away from him. And I remember for a brief moment thinking, dang, I wish John Edward was there, because I think John Edward could beat him. Not only could John Edward beat him and depose him, but I think John Edward could win the national election that year, which would be a hell of a rebuke for the Democratic Party in the way that it seems to be shaping up as just an extended arm of corporate America and this is not only just from 2000, this goes back into the 60s and more, actually, basically since their creation, but they are just a wing of the same bird, this industrial capitalist bird. So I suppose, with all that said, I suppose now you're kind of sitting there saying, wow, I didn't realize it was that bad. I didn't realize this had really taken place. What do we do about it? Well, If you consider yourself a progressive, you have to answer yourself one major question. What kind of progressive are you? And I know I use the term aggressive progressive, but we need to now understand that progressivism is more of a noun than a verb. Meaning it is kind of a thing. It's a motion, I call it. Progressivism is a motion. It's not actually a verb. Or, maybe I have it wrong. Maybe it is a verb. But then again, who knows? Anyway, instead of using all of that, let me just say this. Progressivism is it's a motion. You can put certain criteria to it, but it's still a motion. It begs a question. When you say you're a progressive, okay, well, what kind of progressive are you? Are you a progressive like Bernie Sanders, who's moving towards socialism? Or are you a progressive like John Boehner? And I know many of you go, whoa, he's a conservative. But he's a conservative with a progressive agenda. And his progressive agenda is a freer corporate state. So he's a libertarian, and I believe the type of libertarian that he would be called is an agorist. A-G-O-R-I-S-T. Agorist. And that's where you let market players rule the system. That's the type of progressive he is. Bernie Sanders is a socialist. He's an agorist. What kind of progressive are you? If you say, well, I'm a liberal progressive, then you're not a progressive at all. You're looking to basically stand still. As I think Chris Hedges has wonderfully documented, liberals are meant to be the center. If you're a progressive, you're already working from the center. You're trying to work from the center. You're working from liberalism. Where are you going? Where are you going? Are you going to libertarian mutualism? Are you going to communism? There's progressives who want communism. Real communism, not the crap that the Soviet Union did. Real communism is built from the bottom. Does have a small central government, but it has a lot of cooperative entities for or within the structure of the government to make sure that each commune is represented in a collective planning instrument. But okay, or are you going to something else? What kind of progressive are you? We knew what kind of progressives Eliot Spitzer and John Edwards were. The question is, with their public assassination, are we going to allow true progressive thought, which is connected to one of these more radical elements, one of these things that want to change the system from the root up, are we going to allow real progressivism to die? Because right now, the progressive mind is just about wholly captured by the Democratic Party and the political structure. It is. And if we continue to believe that the only way that we can be progressive is if we are liberal progressives, then we are creating a deadly U-turn, which enables progressives then to vote for individuals who want to take you to the right. What do I mean? Well, as I said, a progressive, a real progressive, is a person who is connected to one of these what we call radical solutions, which wants radicalism, keyword to it is root. It means that you want to change the system from the root up. Well, if you're no longer being connected to those things, if you're no longer being connected to that radical solution, you'd form a U-turn and you start going back to liberalism. So you're a progressive liberal. Well, if you perform that U-turn, you're going to crash right into liberalism, and you're going to then crash through it. And you're going to be put on the path of voting for conservatives who want to, quote, maintain the status quo, basically. They don't want, you know, they talk about the middle class and expanding the middle class and the dream for everybody. Yet they also say, but we need to do it working within corporations. We need to do it working with corporations. We need to do it by privatizing the government. And in exchange, you'll get a little bit of what you want. Very little, but you'll get it. So you form this deadly U-turn, which crashes in between the center wall of liberalism and pushes people then to vote for conservative Democrats, which I'll tell you, this year, people did it. People did it. People said, you know, I'm going to vote for the Democratic Party because I can't vote for the Republicans. The Republicans are so bad. So I'm going to, in essence, vote for the lesser of two evils. And when they voted for the lesser of two evils, they voted a whole lot of Democratic blue dogs. And now, of course, many of these blue dogs don't look like blue dogs. They look like moderates. And indeed, the Blue Dog Caucus got smaller. Of course it got smaller. People understand now in the Democratic Party that you can't run as a blue dog. Because even in the most Republican states, the Democrats aren't being fooled anymore. They say blue dogs are just Republicans with a D next to their names. So these individuals ran as moderates. They ran as moderates, and they got in because they ran as moderates. They said, we need to work within the structure, which I've heard so many middle-class leftists say, we need to work within the structure, and in turn for working with all of these negative, demonic forces out here, the devil and his little minions, in return of doing that, we're going to give you a little bit of what you want, but we ain't really going to change anything. You know, so for instance, right now, the fiscal cliff conversation is going on. And Obama, who is ready to give away the house, he's ready to say, we're going to cut stuff for students, we're going to cut stuff for military, we're going to cut stuff for this, we're going to cut stuff for that. And I just need you guys to give me a little itty-bitty little bit of a tax hike for the people who are making way too much money. Sounds like a blue dog to me. Progressives need to straighten up their back. Like I said, we knew what Edwards stood for. We knew what Spitzer stood for. What do you stand for as a progressive? Where do you want to take this country? Where are you progressing towards? Or is that even a question? Do you even question yourself about that? Well, many of you say, well, I want an egalitarian society. Okay, that's nice. That's really nice. How do you propose that we get there? See, because egalitarianism is not a political structure. Heck, it's barely a social structure. It's a philosophy. So you got to now start looking at what is your social, what kind of paradigm do you want your social model to have? Communistic, cooperative, community? Neighborhood? Think your economic model, which is economic philosophy, is egalitarianism. Okay. What's next? There's deeper questions that must be asked here. And too many progressives don't ask those questions. So, I want to thank you for listening. Any questions, comments, concerns, you can send to me at Class War Battlefield Podcast at live.com. You can find me on Facebook, Class War Battlefield Podcast. Like me if you would. I am on Twitter, and that's the Angelic Soldier, S-O-J-O-U-R. That's at the Angelic Soldier. And I hope you enjoyed this. I really do. This coming up year, 2013, there's a lot that I'm planning. I'm planning on introducing some new things, introducing some old things that are going to be new because I didn't introduce them this year. But I have a lot of things that I want to do for Class War Battlefield Podcast. And with your help and your support, not only for this podcast, but for RadioForAll.net, which we are on exclusively, they'll happen. This is Vyamir D saying, stay strong in the struggle, my people, with much love. I bid you a good day. Peace.
There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and there are lives in the balance.
Thank you.